entering the eye of the lucky corpse, destroying the brain as the shell bounced around in the rotting skull. I loaded 10 rounds into the magazine and told him to go to town, killing the fully mobile creatures first. Soon, the shoreline was littered with nearly 20 still corpses. In total, this little shooting lesson used up 20 rounds. We still had almost 822 rounds. We pretty much drew every corpse within a 10-mile radius to our position. No matter. Better to draw them here than back to the marina. I pulled anchor and sped farther up the coastline, leading them further away from the marina. After 5 minutes of this, I flipped her around and headed away from the island to mask the sound of our return. When we were reasonably close, we cut the engines and paddled back to the stronghold. I feel a little better about taking William with me now that he is more confident in himself. March 9th, 2047 hours. Food. Not critical yet, but a revised estimate of 5 days remaining. Yesterday and today were interesting. My humanity bucket hadn't been filled for a while, and it was getting dry and rustic. After the marital spat John and I witnessed today, I know that this plague cannot and will not destroy human nature. Since there was no television, and taking nice walks through the city was not encouraged, this was my entertainment most of the morning. It wasn't my nostalgia that they were fighting about, it was theirs. But the pre-apocalypse nature of the fight moved me. It was a simple fight over laundry and housework, and who actually did it around the house before all of this. It felt so good to hear a normal conversation for once, and not once hearing about how we were going to avoid one of those things biting our asses off. Laura wants to go outside and play, like her friends at school get to do. I tried to explain to her, with my limited, small people knowledge, that it wouldn't be any fun to play outside right now, and that the people out there wouldn't be nice. She looked at me and rolled her eyes and said,
"I know they are dead. You don't have to play."
I was shocked at the little girl's candor and just sort of chuckled under my breath. I wondered which parent she took the attitude from. Using my knife, I carved a chessboard into the table in the lounge area of the marina. I stole some fishing lures from the marina retail area, and John and I are utilizing them, sans the hooks, as chess pieces. So far, I have him 3-2. I have a strange feeling that William and Jan have made amends for the silly argument, as I can hear no loud voices through the other end of the privacy curtain I put up for them a few days ago. I gave my last few sets of foam earplugs to the Grishams. Laura was fascinated at how they returned to their original shape after you squeezed them. John still had his set in his pant pockets. I had no earplugs left, so I took 2 9-millimeter rounds out of the ammo box and stuffed them in my ear. They were a good fit and really drowned out their moans last night. Enemy activity. Sporadic movement. Last night's full moon brought hundreds of them near us. Using NVGs, I studied them. They seemed to be more active. Could this be because of the full moon? I doubt it. March 10th, 12:22 hours. The radio station stopped playing music today. For a brief moment, I heard a human voice on the other end. It sounded like I heard the word fortify before the microphone cut out. John and I were playing chess again when it happened. Now, I can't even pull John away from the CB radio. He keeps trying to broadcast in the hopes that whoever stopped the music will hear and respond. The station is broadcasting out of Corpus, so I know for a fact they are overrun. I also know that the radio John is using won't reach that far. Whatever keeps his spirits up, I suppose. William and I spoke about his chemistry skills. I asked him if he could make anything useful, considering our current situation. He said that if he had the ingredients, he could make pretty much anything. With William being a chemist and John being an engineer, I'm sure they can come up with something to help our current predicament. Thought. I wonder what historical sites were destroyed that Laura will never see. I remember visiting the Alamo last year. I wonder if anyone alive was holding their ground in the true last stand of the Alamo when the warhead hit. Maybe it answered a prayer. March 12th, 21:43 hours. Food, 2 days remaining. Water, still have pressure, however starting to taste funny. We'll need purification tablets soon. If I develop any symptoms, i.e. diarrhea, I will have to find some purification tablets or simply boil it. William knows the time to leave is coming. Tomorrow we will have to head out for supplies or starve here. It is raining and the water is getting choppy, causing the marina to wobble just enough to induce discomfort. No signal on the formerly good radio station. I have been studying the map I procured last trip very closely. There are other options to scavenging. We could head northeast up the coastline and cherry pick, but run the risk of boat mechanical failure, which would put us in a world of shit. Another option is to go back to Old Faithful Sea Drift. Across San Antonio Bay, on the western shoreline, is another small town called Ostwell. I figure we might as well check it out while we are gathering supplies and food. I need extra batteries for the NVGs and some first aid supplies. John is recovering nicely and almost has limited mobility of his arm. The lacerations are healing, but without stitches, he will have to take it easy for a while. Jan used duct tape to dress the wounds and keep them closed. Yet another use for it. William promised Laura that he would bring her back something from our trip. I suppose it was customary when William went away on business to bring his little girl something back. I will do my best to make sure that happens. I really dread these outings, and wonder if there will ever be a time when I can walk freely again. I will continue making the shopping list tonight, and then I will gas up the boat in the dark to avoid attention. I'm going to try to be in the sack by midnight. March 13th, 07:43 hours. Ready to leave. The equipment is loaded onto the boat. It has stopped raining, and the water is not as choppy. Left my Walter P-99 with John and Jan. Not much firepower left behind for them, but I don't think they will need it. Our destination is Ostwell, Texas, opposite side of San Antonio Bay from Sea Drift. Ostwell is also a small dot on the map, hopefully indicating a small population of undead. This outing serves two purposes. One, to get William more comfortable with being among them so we can plan for a bigger picture. Secondly, to gather much-needed supplies. We now have 6 souls in our little marina island, including Annabelle, and with 2 people, I estimate we can only gather maybe a week's worth of food at a time. This means that we are theoretically forced out into their world once a week, which in my opinion is one time too many. I need to step out of the box with my shopping. Yes, the junk food, soup cans, and other things we have been looting are great, but the lack of vitamins and exercise is catching up with me. My metabolism has slowed down from lack of being able to run. Luck be with us. 22:33 hours. After leaving the marina and paddling out to a safe engine distance, we cranked it up and sped toward San Antonio Bay. I could see birds in the air, and the smell of the open air was refreshing. Soon the Texas mainland was in plain view in front of us. Entering the bay was exactly like the 2 times before. After reaching the western shore, a few private docks could be seen. Up a small hill from each of them stood a large house. I suppose the docks were for the owner's boats, although I could see none tied up. We cut the engines and started our 2-man rowing toward the shoreline. I sat and thought about how silly I would look to an onlooker if this had never happened. I closed my mind and continued to row, imagining that everything was normal. It was a complete mess. Windows were shattered, rats, trash, newspapers, everything was blowing around the dock and street. There was a large parking lot in the asphalt area beyond the marina ramp. I could see 5 creatures surrounding a white compact car and beating their rotting hands on the windows. I could not see inside of the car from this distance and angle. I assumed that there was definitely something in the car that the creatures were after, and an even further assumption would be that it was alive, whatever it was. Quietly, we rowed to the tie-up point and docked the boat. I slung my empty pack on my back, put the pry bar in my belt, put some heavy plastic zip ties in my pocket and readied my weapon, then stepped into this new world. I didn't look behind me, but I could feel William's presence there. I could almost smell his fear. I was probably more afraid than he was. Scanning the area, we crept across the ramp to the shore, eyes trained on the small white ford that was surrounded by the dead. As soon as I set foot on terra firma, I grabbed a fist-sized rock on the shore, threw it as hard as I could, about 20 meters beyond the car, into the windshield of a large black truck. It sounded like someone beat a snare drum when the rock hit home. The things instantly stood erect and started walking toward the area beyond the car. I told William to stay back and watch for them while I checked things out. I was almost on top of it. The car was an arm's length away. I reached out to touch the hood, feeling its cold surface. I could see a figure with the seat down, lying in the driver's seat. It was an attractive woman that looked in her early 20s. The car windows were caked with dried rot and pus from the creature's relentless pounding. Most of the windows were cracked in a spiderweb pattern. I put my face up to the window to get a closer look at the woman. She looked dead. I could see signs of extreme dehydration in her face. Her lips were dry and flaky. The creatures that were gathered here were now preoccupied elsewhere. I called William over. I asked him how long it took for one to turn. I remember him telling me he had witnessed this before. He said that he had seen a man die in the street as he watched from the attic of his home, and he turned within the hour. Nothing made sense. There was an open bottle of aspirin spilled out onto the passenger seat, and empty plastic water bottles strewn all over the car. She couldn't have been dead longer than a day. I suppose the question I was asking myself was, why didn't she turn like the others? In the back seat, I could see numerous fast food beverage cups filled with what looked like feces and urine. She had been trapped in this car for what looked like a few days. Then there was movement. First, her mouth gestured a weak yawn, and then her eyes started to flutter. I trained my weapon on her and told William to watch my back and keep a lookout in the immediate area. Expecting to see the familiar milky death orb staring at me, I was surprised when she opened her eyes, and I could see the blue in her irises. She looked up at me in shock. To her, I was a strange man wearing a mask with a machine gun pointed at her. She looked behind her and around the car and, with her lips only, said with no voice,
"I'm alive."
I pulled off my mask and went to the door to open it. It was locked. She smiled and looked at me and unlocked it. I took her arm and helped her out of the car. She stank worse than those things. Maybe it was the car. I had to support her as she walked. She was very weak and sore from being trapped in the car. Looking over my shoulder, I motioned William to follow me back to the boat. After reaching the Bahama Mama, I sat her down, gave her some water and some canned beef, my lunch. I told her not to eat or drink anything too fast. I didn't have time to stay and chat. William had his instructions. He was to row the boat out 20 meters and drop anchor and wait for me. I was going shopping. As I stepped back onto the dock, I could hear William rowing the boat away from me. I reached the parking lot again, and I could see more than 5 in the area. I stayed low and followed the shoreline toward the town. No sign of life anywhere. No dog, cat, nothing. I didn't even see any birds flying over this town. I was coming up on a group of buildings. I cut inland and walked toward what was the center of the small town of Ostwell, Texas. After a few hundred meters of walking, I stepped through a clearing. I could see a Walgreens and a gas station. I doubt Walgreens had any food, but I was certain they had medical supplies. I crept up to the front door, sticking to the wall. This door was different in the way that it actually had chains holding the doors shut from the inside. There would be no way for me to get in without busting the glass and attracting them. I walked to the back of the store. There was a drive-up window for the pharmacy there. That side of the building faced the woods. There could be hundreds of them in there looking at me, and I wouldn't know it. I couldn't feel them, But then again, I wonder if that sense still exists when it comes to their kind. There was a steel exterior cargo shutter door, probably for new shipments. Tried to lift it up, locked tight. I really need to get a book on lockpicking from the local library. I pulled out the bar from my belt. I placed the bar under the shutter underneath the keyhole. After a few minutes of prying, cursing, and sweating, I finally broke the lock. I checked my surroundings, noticed that I had garnered some unwanted attention one block away and closing. I attached my LED light to my carbine and twisted it on. It was dark in the cargo area as it was separate from the skylit main retail part of the store. I shined the light into the room. I could only see boxes, steel shelves, and various other normal things. I jumped up into the loading bay. Just as I started to slide the shutter door down, two of them rounded the corner and caught sight of me. I slammed the garage door type shutter down and immediately thought of a way to secure it. I held the shutter down with the bottom of my boot just as the first creature started beating on the metal. They would attract more. The plastic zip ties in my pocket would do no good, as I had nothing on the ground to secure the door to. I glanced over to the corner of the room where I found a mop and some nylon string. Walking over the corner, I kept my right foot along the lip of the door and my left for balance. Grabbing the mop, I wedged it between the rollers that made the door slide up smoothly. Using the twine, I secured it in place. There was a heavy box on the shelf full of plastic bottles of mouthwash. I sat the box on the lip of the door where my foot was. This wouldn't work forever, but it would have to work for now. After I was satisfied that the door would hold for at least a little while, I stepped into the pharmacy. Numerous pharmaceutical books lined the shelves. Picking up the physician's desk reference, I scanned it for any possible useful information regarding medication. I would love to take this back to Jan, but it was a rather large book and would take up valuable backpack space. There was another book listing numerous antibiotics. Using this book, I grabbed bags of pills left in the pickup bin that would never be claimed. Basically anything with a biotic on the end of it found its home in the plastic Ziploc bag in my pack. Jumping over the counter, I landed on the main floor and immediately pointed my weapon toward a blind spot of the store. Looking up, I noticed that this store had convex observation mirrors, enabling easy view of most of the area. I checked the mirrors and cleared the store, row by row. The creatures were still steadily banging on the back shutter door. I hated this. I felt rushed. Tylenol, hydrogen peroxide, bandages, band-aids. I stuffed them all in the big Ziploc freezer bag with the antibiotics. I saw some iodine on the shelf and remembered in Navy survival school that iodine worked as a water purifier. I tossed it in the pack. I was thirsty. I grabbed a warm bottle of water off the shelf and downed it. My pack was halfway full. I passed the candy bar section and grabbed a chocolate bar. Opening it, I realized how long it had been since all of this started. The bar was long stale. No matter. I needed energy. On the toy aisle, I found a small teddy bear and put it in the pack. After eating the candy, I started looking for my escape. I was at the main entrance doors. The chain was a standard heavy steel chain. I didn't want to walk in front of the doors in case I had to use this as a way out. There was no way I would get that heavy steel master lock off without either shooting the hell out of it or hitting it 100 times with a fire axe. I grabbed some duct tape off the store shelf. Quietly, not that it mattered over the sound of the creatures in the back slamming against the metal shutter, I taped up the bottom section of the glass door, making sure that I was not seen. It took a few minutes, but soon the whole section was covered. Then, using the fire extinguisher from behind the counter, I bashed it outward. It wasn't as loud as it could have been, but still too loud for me. Quickly, I headed back the way I came, through the wooded area toward the marina parking lot. I had been gone for over an hour. I ran through the woods. I was nearly sprinting. I could see the clearing ahead of me. There were two of them in the woods in front of me. I juked them and kept running. When I hit the clearing, my heart stopped. There were so many of them. I skirted the parking lot, avoiding attention. I had no choice but to make myself known. I ran out toward the dock, and I knew that they saw me. Their orchestrated moans bounced off the water and echoed from all directions, nearly demoralizing me into the fetal position. I was in flight mode. I called out to William. No sight of the boat. I kept running. Still no boat. Looking back, I could see them all converging on the dock. No way out. I had 10 feet of dock left, and the things were 20 feet from my position. They were so hungry. They were rotted, putrid evil. In their frenzy, they knocked their fellow demons into the water, just to be the first to eat my flesh. I turned and ran. I dove into the water and started swimming away. I did the side stroke for a full minute before I started treading water and looking back toward the dock. The dock was full of bodies, so full that many fell off from lack of standing room. There I was, treading water, alone. I kept imagining that there was something below the water tugging on my boots. I was terrified and accidentally swallowed some water down the wrong pipe and imagined how many of those things were rotting in the murky deep. Then came the hum of an engine. I still had all my gear strapped to my body, but it is surprising how easy it is to float if you just blow some air into your clothing. I waved excitedly at the boat. It was William. He saw me. The boat went to idle and drifted over to my position with the engine still running. I handed William my pack and my rifle from the water. I then pulled myself on board. William told me that the parking lot filled shortly after I left. He had no choice but to try and drive them away from the marina for my safety. I checked my backpack. Only a little water seeped into the freezer bags, not enough to hurt the contents. We headed back to John, Jan, Laura, and Annabelle. I was wet, cold, and without the food I set out to get. If the boat had not shown, I don't know where I would have ended up. I'm not sure how long I could have swam, and would have undoubtedly been followed down the shoreline until I was too tired to swim any longer. Admitting defeat, my tired body would have been torn apart as I stumbled into the shallows, into open arms. Ides of March. March 15th, 1822 hours. I spent yesterday and today fighting off a cold from my recent swimming adventure, and also cleaning and drying my rifle. Only in a world like this could a common cold mean a death sentence. It's not bad. I just feel weaker than normal and a little fever. Jan advises against using any antibiotics unless in dire need, as she claims the body would get used to the medication and it would do no good in the future if really needed. Jan also tended to the new arrival, Tara. Tara had been trapped in that car for days. She was on the verge of dying from dehydration when William and I showed up. She was feeling better. Tara had made sure she stayed hydrated and in bed. I caught her looking at me a few times today. She didn't catch me, but I did the same. She was attractive, and I am human. I overheard her conversation with Jan about how she got to the dock. Trapped in her house in Austwell, she saw an opportunity for escape. She made it to the marina and was spotted by three of them while looking for a boat to escape in. She had no choice but to seek shelter in the nearest unlocked car she could find. Tara was a marketing major at a local junior college. She commented on how none of it mattered and figured that her marketing career was now over before it started. Both women laughed at this. William and John took the boat out and caught 10 fish yesterday. John was up to it, and I figured some sun would do him good. Laura asked me how my trip to the store went. I told her it went fine, and that I was sorry I didn't find her anything to eat. She said it was okay, and that her daddy didn't bring her anything back from the trip anyway. I remembered the bear. I gave it to William so he could sun-dry it before giving it to her, as it got wet when I jumped in the water to escape the creatures. I told Laura not to be sad, and that he had a present for her, and he was just waiting for the right time to give it to her. She smiled and walked off to investigate. Raw fish isn't my favorite entree, but millions of Japanese can't be wrong. Well, maybe there are a million of them left alive. I wouldn't know. Once again, my personal Groundhog Day is coming, and I dread leaving again. We need a better life, and a better place to live. March 17th, 1833 hours. Around the table, we were, like knights of old, discussing our battle plans. Jan, Tara, John, William, and myself discussed at length all possibilities for finding a new place to live. An island stronghold has a certain mystique and attraction. However, we ruled this out due to the constant need to travel to the mainland and scavenge. Where would a defensible position exist that was not near a major city? There was a large map of the United States on the wall in the gift shop. It had no detail, just rivers and state lines and capital cities. I pulled the map off the wall, and we all studied it at length. My own selfish reasons kicked in, and I suggested we take a boat along the coastline and cruise up the Mississippi River to find a suitable location. Would be nearer to my parents. That was one option. William suggested we go by land to avoid the catastrophic effect of boat mechanical failure. John suggested sailing along the coast around southern Florida and straight to the Bahamas. Everyone smiled at that idea, but it goes back to having a limited supply of goods and the need to scavenge. We were safe for now, as all the noise our boat engine has been making on our fishing, scavenging trips has been fooling them to other parts of the island. But this wouldn't last forever. We needed a more permanent place to live. We are all playing poker tonight as a morale booster. Lara, Annabelle, and Tubby the teddy bear have other plans. They are playing house. Refulgence of Claudia. March 18th, 2148 hours. We have been living off of fish the past few days. I found a propane cooking plate on one of the larger boats in the marina and finally had some cooked meat. We have different food now. I ventured out on the island today with William. We took the Bahama Mama out west along the island coast to find some food. According to my map, Matagorda Island is roughly 25 miles long and 2 to 3 miles wide. I thought about rigging a sound device up by remote as a distractor for these things, as to draw them to a certain point on the island while William and I explore other parts. John is working on the idea. William and I found something of interest today. We must have went 10 miles west along the coast when something appeared inland behind some trees. It looked like some sort of tower. When we got closer, it became apparent that this was the island's lighthouse. It was a large black spire rising up roughly 150 feet with a large glass lens room at the top. At the base of the lighthouse stood the keeper's home, I assume. This area seemed secluded, but I knew it wouldn't be longer than a couple hours before the sound of our engines would bring them to our general location. We dropped anchor 10 feet from dry land. I jumped out into the ankle-high water. It was warm. This area was more rural than the marina area. The upside to this is less living population equals less dead population. The downside was that the trees were blocking my view to most of the area around the lighthouse. William had gotten better with the .22 rifle the past few days. We were down to 722 rounds for his weapon, and I only had 450 223 rounds, a little target practice for me also. We crept up to the wooded area around the lighthouse. Something was making noise, though. The closer we got to the structure, the louder the noise was. It was a constant, even interval banging noise, but still no visual sign of the undead. We were at the clearing. The lighthouse looked very old. I'm sure at one point its flat black paint was glossy, but years of salt air and rain have made their mark. The house attached to the bottom of the lighthouse seemed more modern. 3 months' worth of weeds and grass grew in the yard. The banging noise was obviously coming from the direction of the lighthouse. We moved in. I kept signaling him to check our flank as to avoid a possible rear assault. Bang, bang, bang. The noise kept on, similar to the timing of a second hand on a clock. William and I walked the perimeter of the lighthouse house. It was obviously the direction the noise was coming from. The basement access door on the back side of the house was shaking with every pound made below. I wasn't 100% sure, but I knew what was down there. I knew the door was secure, for some odd reason, from the outside, and whatever was down there would stay down there until the door rotted off the hinges, or I let it out. We approached the front door to the house. It was not locked, but the windows were boarded up, which, for the life of me, I couldn't figure out. I carefully turned the knob and flung the door open, and both of us jumped back, aiming our weapons. We must have looked ridiculous. The house smelled of rotting flesh. Not good. I almost wanted to say fuck it and just live off of fish for the rest of my life. But I was here, and we all needed food and supplies. The floor of this seaside dwelling was old and wooden. Every creak sounded like thunder. We were in the living room. I whispered to William, "Do you think there is a door to the basement inside the house?" He wasn't sure. I hoped there wasn't. On the floor, I immediately noticed dried blood. It led to the hallway. Bloody handprints were apparent, and looked as if someone or something dragged itself into the hallway. I went first, and William followed. Rounding the corner to the hall, I noticed that the blood trail curved into what I thought was a bedroom. I followed it, heart pounding, sweating, scared. I was at the door where the trail led. The door was shut, and the dried, bloody handprints were all over the bottom half of it. I listened and reached for the knob. No sound. I quietly turned the knob and opened the door an inch, and rot hit my nostrils. I could see a pair of legs clothed in dirty jeans lying on the bed. I walked in. I saw what was left of a man, I think. His plaid shirt and denim were caked with blood, and his head, from the nose up, was gone. Maggots infested the open wounds, and I could see his skin move from the crawling larva underneath. The 12-gauge hunting shotgun sat on his chest. Pulling the shotgun from his rotting grip, I noticed a yellow piece of paper with writing in black ink. February 12th. My dearest Claudia, I love you so much. I know you are in heaven looking down, and you know the pain I am feeling. Even though that is not you in the basement, still, I can't bring myself to do it. Please forgive me for not giving you peace. I am a coward. May God forgive me for what I am about to do. I will always love you. Frank. I handed the note to William. None of us spoke for the next few minutes. The shotgun was a nice find, and so were the three boxes of shells on the dresser. We checked inside the dresser, in the sock drawer, and found a .357 Smith & Wesson revolver with a box of 50 shells. Next was the kitchen. The canned goods, cooking oil, and spices, and anything else non-perishable were coming with us. There wasn't as much food as I expected to find. The incessant banging kept on relentlessly. Claudia wasn't giving up. I remembered seeing a wheelbarrow around back near the basement door. I took it to the front, and William and I filled it with our findings. I told William my thoughts about the basement, and that there may be more food and weapons down there. We agreed to open the door and take care of Claudia. William volunteered to open the door and let me shoot. Carefully, he slid the T-handle lock up out of the concrete sleeve, unlocking the door. The banging continued. She didn't know we were here. She just knew she was hungry and wanted out. I dreaded the thought of looking at her. William grabbed the handle and was about to pull when I told him to wait. There was a safer way. I told William to find some rope or twine in the house. After a few minutes, he came back with a ball of knitting yarn from one of the spare bedrooms. I had him double it up and tie it to the handle and step back 15 or so feet. I gave him the signal, and he yanked the doubled-up yarn, pulling the door open. There she was, rotted, putrid, evil. Her rotting, milky eyes locked onto us, and what was left of her lips curled back over her yellow, jagged teeth. Her hands were nothing more than bloody nubs from countless weeks of impact with the wooden cellar door. She lunged for us. Just as she reached the outside of the doorway, she tripped over the top step and tumbled face first into the ground. I took this opportunity to give her the peace that Frank could not. I shot the back of her head at point-blank range, sending her back to her husband. The cellar was dark and foreboding. I switched on the flashlight mounted on my rifle. The bright LED light filled the stairwell. Giving my eyes a moment to adjust, I thought about what other horrors could or would be lurking down here in the bowels of this old lighthouse. I stepped down into the darkness and found no creatures, living or dead. Claudia was it. I called William down to help. There were countless mason jars filled with green beans, yams, and other vegetables. There was also a considerable wine selection and more canned goods. It looked as if Frank and Claudia originally held up down here, as a bed, stove, and refrigerator were in place, and a Remington 7mm mag hunting rifle with a scope sat barrel up, propped in the corner. On top of the refrigerator were two boxes of 7mm shells. We took as much food as we could carry, along with the hunting rifle. We filled our packs with food, weapons, and ammunition. The majority of the goods we found went in the wheelbarrow. I took off my pack and told William I would be back shortly. I walked toward the lighthouse. I wanted to go to the top to get a better view and see if we could expect any company. Round and round I went up the spiral staircase to the apex of the spire. Reaching the top, I scanned the area. In the direction we came from, east, I could see maybe 20 of those things milling about in a group headed our general direction. The sound of our boat and the gunshot were the catalysts. I judged by their current rate of movement that we had plenty of time to leave. I ran back down the stairs and William and I took turns pushing the wheelbarrow back to the boat. We loaded up the mama and headed back home. We got lucky today. March 20th, 15:17 hours. I just received a radio broadcast over the Citizen Band radio. The person claimed to be a congressman from the state of Louisiana, safe in a bunker 100 miles north of New Orleans. His voice was rugged and tired. He went on to claim that he had many surviving soldiers of the Louisiana National Guard with him. The reason for his announcement was to warn any possible survivors of the threats posed by the radiation-exposed undead. Apparently, New Orleans was destroyed in the strategic nuclear bombing campaign. The congressman had sent out scouts equipped with dosimeters and Geiger counters to survey the damage to the city and the undead ranks. Out of the 10 sent out, 6 returned. The scouts reported to the congressman that the radiation-riddled undead showed little signs of decomposition and were faster and more coordinated than their non-irradiated counterparts. The radiation was somehow preserving them. One of the soldiers even claimed that they thought they heard one of the creatures speak a simple word. Of the 4 scouts that were killed, 2 of them died from being overran by a dozen irradiated undead on the interstate outside of New Orleans. The other 2 died from radiation exposure because they unknowingly spent the night in a fire truck drenched with radiation, as the other scouts slept safely in a concrete drainage pipe 5 feet underground. The congressman claims to have limited high-frequency teletype communications with a base equipped with squadrons of prototype UAVs and warehouses full of high-ordnance military explosives. According to the broadcast, EMP burst has rendered much of the non-shielded electronics around the devastated city useless. The scouts had no luck hotwiring cars or finding salvageable radio equipment. This is something that I will file into the back of my mind for future reference in the event my luck is bad enough to find myself inside the blast radius aftermath. John tried to respond to the transmission. However, our low-power transmitter didn't have the juice to make it that far. Maybe on a low overcast, cloudy day, but not today. Just another thing to worry about. March 22nd, 18:54 hours. Tara is an interesting woman. I have to hand it to her for surviving. I can't begin to imagine her feelings of defeat as she sat in that compact car and listened to them beat the glass for days. She told me that she spent one whole day attracting them to one side of the car so that she could crack the window on the opposite side for a few precious seconds of cool air before they shambled back over. I haven't seen her break down and cry yet, but It is a natural thing, and I'm sure it will come. Laura is in her own little world with Annabelle and her teddy bear. I have feelings of dread for the day that will come soon, the day we must move on. I somehow feel like I am responsible for everyone here. It would be too much to bear to lose any of them. However, I know that sooner or later, statistics will catch up with us. I have become decently good at chess, and John and I are about 50-50 when we play. William woke up last night at around 0200 hours. I was awake, looking at the map. He told me that he dreamed of our lighthouse trip, and that the woman in the cellar, Claudia, didn't trip in his dream. I thought about what he was getting at, and just tried to put it out of my mind. I haven't seen any of them since our trip. We have been successful in confusing them with our boat gunshot noise diversions. No transmissions from Louisiana today or yesterday. We have been vigilant in having at least one person within earshot of the radio at all times. I have been in a slump since the lighthouse, so I decided to shave today for morale. Amazing how the feel of a good shave can make you feel more human. I have been thinking about how many of them there are. I wonder just how outnumbered we are, and just how much of the professional military was left. I remember the last U.S. Census back in 2000, and how they claimed there were close to 300 million people in the U.S. I have no way of knowing how many survivors there are, but I am certain that they outnumber us. I would say that the nuclear campaign cleared out a few million, including the living. I suppose I just don't have enough data for any kind of accurate estimate. Drizzling rain dominates the visibility. Spring is coming, and so are the storms. March 23rd, 18-19 hours. We received another transmission from Louisiana. This time, it was very garbled. The voice on the other end claims that all communications with NORAD have ceased. The theory they are posing is that it probably fell from the inside. They are trying to hack a video feed from their command center north of New Orleans. However, attempts to do so have proven unsuccessful. John is still drawing up some rough plans for a distractor to be used against the creatures. I also asked him to start thinking about a mobile way to charge dead batteries, as I feel that many of the car batteries on the mainland would be as dead as their owners. We are building the groundwork for escape and evasion. To where is not yet certain. March 24th, 23:39 hours. We have not been affected by radiation fallout. We should avoid the former major cities, as I'm sure deadly amounts of radiation will exist there, as evident from the reports of the dead scouts. There is also a matter of the other information received a few days ago from Louisiana. I can hear them moaning. The wind is carrying it, and it feels like they are right outside the window. I know this is not the case, but the thought of it is very disturbing. It is not a human moan. It sounds like a deep, throaty sound, low and unnatural. I need to check the perimeter. March 26th, 20:03 hours. The creatures cannot swim, however they can exist in the water. It was clear outside today, and the water was calm. I decided to go outside on the docks to get some sun. I brought my rifle in an attempt to make sure everyone was safe on our outing. Little Laura was looking pale from lack of sun, and I just felt guilty that she never got any outside time. I stood, facing the shore as the others took off their shoes and let their feet dangle over the edge of the dock into the water. As I scanned the shoreline, I saw no movement, vice the tormented creatures that were trapped in the hotel room across the street from our location. I checked back over my shoulder, and they seemed to be enjoying themselves. They were being quiet, and conscious of the dangers that lurked in the urban area around us. I looked down into the water, and noticed something dark moving about under the surface. The dark green seawater restricted my visibility. I called John over, and told William to stay and watch the others, and to tell them to get their feet out of the water. On the wall of the marina was a round foam life preserver, similar to the ones seen on ships, and a lifeguard hook for grabbing people out of the water. I glanced at the hook and glanced at John. He brought it over to me as I continued to gaze into the green abyss. I saw it again. Something large was definitely moving under the surface. I had John grab my belt and hold me solid as I dipped the long hook into the water. I felt it hit the object. After a few minutes of pulling and tugging, I finally snagged it. As I pulled the rotting thing through the deep, I lamented over all the fish we had eaten in the weeks prior that had probably fed on this man's body. It was flailing, and the mouth gaped and gnashed. As it opened its mouth in an attempt to take a bite out of me, I saw stagnant water pour out of the thing's throat, and a low gurgle ensued. It had no eyes, as they had surely been eaten by fish weeks before. This thing had been in the water a long time. I pulled it up onto the dock. As the torso cleared the water, it was apparent that the thing had no legs either. It was still dangerous, so I decided to quietly dispatch it with a careful knife stab through the left eye socket. Using the hook bar, I held the head still as I carefully slid the knife home, neutralizing the pitiful fuck. It would be a long time before I ever decided to take a leisurely swim in any body of water. I slid the dock bridge over to the land using the rope pulley. With the hook pull, I dragged the creature across the street as John covered me with his rifle. Laura saw the creature as I dragged the body away and started crying. I felt bad and hated the thing even more as I dragged the putrid mass across the ground. The corpse left a black stain on the concrete as the slimy torso grinded along the sun-baked pavement. March 27th, 1951 hours. The wind is howling outside. The moans of the creatures seem to be getting louder as the days go by. There are a couple dozen outside the marina, patrolling the shoreline. Every second they are out there, I have to tell myself not to go outside and execute them. There will be 9mm rounds stuck in my ear again tonight, because the noise is maddening. Even in the darkness of the new nightfall, I can still make out the drag marks on the shore from the corpse I neutralized yesterday. We have agreed it is time to move. We set a target date of 1 week. In the meantime, we will be gathering more supplies and thinking of a suitable location. I have come to realize that if you do not move, you die. Even then, you do not die. You exist as them, which is worse. Atlantis. March 28th, 1300 hours. We are in the boat. Early this morning at around 0200 hours, a glass cup that Laura had left on the bait counter the night before fell to the floor for no apparent reason. I immediately stood up on my feet and felt as if I was drunk, and it became difficult to stand up. It felt I was walking uphill toward the broken glass on the floor. I flipped the light switch on and called to John and William. They too felt disoriented, and it finally dawned on me what was happening. I had wondered what took Murphy's Law so long to happen. We were sinking. It stormed last night and rocked us around a bit. I suppose lack of maintenance, inspections, and the wrath of nature finally did the job. We woke the others up, and I suggested to John and William that they start gathering supplies. I had no idea how long we had before the whole marina bait gift shop went down. The imbalance of weight versus buoyancy would eventually snap the lumber support and cause the whole building to sink. I had no time to be quiet. I donned the NVGs and immediately began getting the mama ready. The noise I was making, combined with the creaking, overstressed timber of the marina, had drawn a crowd. Through the graininess of my optics, I could make out roughly 20 creatures. They were god-awful. I felt in my heart that if there was a hell, these things came from there, and in my imagination I could feel their hot, hellish breath all over me. Even though I was almost sure they could not see in the dark, many of them were looking in my direction, attuned to the noise, cocking their heads like a confused dog to its master. Most were in intermediate stages of decomposition, and I could not see their eyes through the goggles, only black circles, which added to their ominous horror. Jan, Tara, John, William, and myself formed a human assembly line as we passed supplies hand over hand to the boat. Only half an hour had went by, and already one of the corners dipped almost 2 feet into the water, causing the opposite corner to hang out of the water a foot or so. This meant the structure was getting overstressed. I put the muzzle on Annabelle and carried her and Laura to the boat and sat them down. The creatures were voicing their demented sounds toward us. I whispered to Laura not to worry, and her job was to hold Annabelle and not let her leave the boat. I handed her the teddy bear and pecked her on the cheek. We loaded the boat down to an almost dangerous load-bearing weight. It was the lowest I had seen her since we started using it. I helped Jan and Tara into the boat and told William to stay, while John and I made one last late checkout hotel room sweep of the place to make sure we didn't leave invaluable items. Satisfied with our sweep, we boarded the boat and I fired the engine up. If it were not for Laura, I would have fragged a few of them that instant, if not only but to make myself feel better. As we pulled away from the marina, I thought back to the places we were forced to take refuge in the past. They seem to be getting less accommodating every time we move. We are now sitting 1 mile off the coast of Texas, approximately. Engine shut off, drifting to conserve fuel. 21:44 hours. Decided to cruise northeast up the Texas coast toward Galveston. Something is wrong with the engine. It keeps flooding. When I finally get the engine started again, it dies 5 minutes later. All hope is looking to be lost. By my approximations, we have gone roughly 75 miles up the coast. We are running low on gas, as I can see the level approaching the floor of the bladder tank. Still, that is not the problem with the boat. I assume it's something to do with the engine, and that means we are either rowing this tub at 1 knot per hour, or we are going to end up on foot. It just can't get any better than this. March 29th, 0605 hours. Oh, yes, it can. After rowing for 4 hours last night, we finally made it to a suitable anchor area away from any dead. After catching only 2 hours of sleep, we had no choice but to take our chances on foot. Tara had expressed to me that she needed to use the restroom, and that after the little problem we had with the creature under the water, she didn't really wish to hang her ass over the side. I guess I can understand. We can't stay on this small boat indefinitely. We paddled the boat near enough to shore for me to see the sandy bottom. I hopped out, ankle deep in salt water, and pulled the boat further into the shore. William was covering me with the lighthouse keeper's shotgun. We unloaded as much as we could carry to the shore. We should be near Freeport, though I can't be sure. Something seemed somehow perilous and foolish with the idea of trekking across mainland Texas with a little girl. I know she is not mine, but for some reason I feel very protective over her. As we sat on the shore, I expressed to the men that we should move in a defensive posture, keeping the females, including Annabelle, in the middle and the males on the ends. We are leaving now and must leave some of the mason jars full of vegetables behind, along with some drinking water. We can't carry all the weight. As we leave the shore, I will take one look back at the Bahama Mama and say my mental goodbye, just as I would a high school car that I had owned for years. 13:41 hours. After 5 hours of marching northwest inland, we are taking a short lunch break. I feel so vulnerable compared to the safety of the marina. Enough of them could easily overpower us. Over the course of the past few hours, we have crossed numerous two-lane highways and some four-lane. We are in rough country, some of it ranch. I guess our position to be somewhere in the vicinity of Sweeney, Texas, but I cannot tell for certain, and I refuse to ask the local population for help. The cacti grow freely everywhere. I suppose I never noticed it before, as I never made a point to just take off on foot across random ranch land. We crossed one of the highways early this morning around 10:30. There was a large six-car pileup about 100 meters away from where we crossed. It looked like a fire truck was on the scene with the ladder extended into the air. I decided to check it out and see if anything was salvageable. Looking at the wreckage, I thought to myself that I really didn't want to risk driving on the highways due to all the pileups we may encounter along our route. I didn't want to be trapped and surrounded by them in anything short of a tank. As I neared the wreck site, my mind started piecing together what happened. I motioned for the others to stay put. The enemy was nigh. On top of the mechanical extended fire truck ladder, a creature, hanging from a safety tether, took notice of my presence. No telling how long it had been hanging there, like a wild animal in a steel trap. This undead public servant was probably a good man in his former life. The bright yellow fireman's clothing was still visible under all the dried blood. A United States flag was stitched on his left sleeve with the date 9/11/01, embroidered into the stars and stripes. I wanted to send this thing away with one well-aimed round, but I knew this was different. We didn't have the safety of the boat to our advantage. I would let it hang there. I walked around to the other side of the wreckage. I figured that this fireman was attacked and took refuge 40 feet up at the top of the ladder for no telling how long. There was a small bucket big enough for one man to sit in at the top. He probably turned into what he is now and inadvertently fell and was doomed to hang there for the rest of his rotting existence from his safety line. There were feces on the ground below the ladder, suggesting he made his stand for probably a few days. My question was, his stand from what? Other than his misfortunate corpse, there was no sign of the undead for as far as I could see to both sides of the wreckage. The bloody handprints at the base of the white mechanical ladder, coupled with the same prints all around the fire truck, told a different story. We continued on into the wasteland of the Texas plains, climbing barbed wire fences and negotiating heavy spring vegetation. We could be traveling for days, if not weeks, before we potentially find anything worth holding up in. 23:12 hours. We are taking refuge inside a chain-link razor wire fence area for the night. We found it out of blind luck after fighting through cactus and heavy foliage for hours. The sign, bolted to the outside of the fence, stated the following. Warning. Controlled area, U.S. government property. It is unlawful to enter this area without the permission of the installation commander. While on this installation, all personnel and the property under their control are subject to search. This area is patrolled by military working dog teams. It was approaching nightfall when John ran into it. We had to take turns carrying Laura for the latter part of the day because her little legs were getting tired and she just couldn't keep up. The fenced area couldn't have been more than 50 feet by 50 feet. I hadn't the slightest idea what the government would want with this small area of land, or why such a big deal would be made for it. I could see the panoramic view of the whole area and saw no sign of life or death besides our group. No building could be seen inside the fence, as it was a flat grassy area similar to a regular yard. The crabgrass had grown rather high, and I suppose if someone were lying down, I would not be able to see them. We had no choice other than sleeping in a tree, and I wasn't much for that option. I grabbed the blankets out of the pack that Tara was carrying and folded them to a width of about 3 feet wide. I left the length the same. The fence was around 8 feet tall, so it took a couple tries, but I finally got the blankets over the razor wire so that I could climb over without cutting myself to shreds. As I hit the ground, I pulled my weapon up to the ready and began checking the grass for any danger. I walked around inside of the fence, then toward the middle of the area. There was a large manhole-type cover just sitting there on the ground. I bent down on one knee and noticed that there was no exterior handle, and if there were, I would definitely not be able to lift it, as there was 4 inches of steel showing above ground. There were very large hinges present on one side of this odd-looking lid. I'm guessing that this lid cover weighs more than all of us combined. I hear nothing but the sound of nature. The stars are very bright tonight, and the fence is secure. If it doesn't rain, it will be a nice night to sleep under the stars. March 30th, 15:17 hours. Our luck has changed. I woke up this morning to the sound of howling dogs in the distance. No way of knowing if they are wild or domesticated. made me think of the sign we read on the fence yesterday. I was very curious why a thick steel manhole lid would be sitting inside a razor wire fence in the middle of nowhere, Texas.